Okay, now, a little bit about the history of Los Tecos itself, the group behind the UAG, the University, the Autonomous University of Guadalajara. This is the largest of the articles from the Albuquerque Journal of 12-1585, again, by Craig Paz, headlined, Teco, School Mascot or Philosophy, subheaded, Mexican College Denies Links to Pro-Nazi Right-Wing Sect. And reading part of the story, because this is a huge story here, about the development of Los Tecos. The organization grew out of the ferment among conservative Catholic university students in the 1930s. Its antecedents sprang from the underground Christian guerrilla organizations that fought in Mexico's Cristero revolutions in the 1920s against the suppression of the church by Mexican dictator Plutarco Elias Calles, C-A-L-L-E-S. Guadalajara was always the stronghold of the movement. The leader of the Tecos and the principal founder of the UAG, according to these accounts, was Carlos Cuesta Gallardo, G-A-L-L-A-R-D-O, a Guadalajara lawyer who died last June. Cuesta Gallardo was sometimes facetiously called the Jew, unquote, by his contemporaries because of his obsessive anti-Semitism and his stint in Hitler's Germany during the war. This is the person Anderson referred to that goes clear back to Hitler Germany. As we'll see, this whole organization has been in business for a long time, well before World War II. Talking about Cuesta Gallardo. He was the ideological mentor of the UAG's current rector and vice-rector and other top UAG administration officials still in power, said law professor Raimundo Guerrero. Now recall that that rector is the aforementioned Luis Garibay, who went to New York to study. Continuing. Luis Calderon Vega, in his 1959 memoirs of the Catholic student movement, said that a few years before the founding of the Autonoma, he received a call from Cuesta Gallardo to meet in a plaza and discuss some business affairs. After walking around the square a number of times to see who might be listening, Cuesta Gallardo explained that he was either forming or wished to expand his secret Catholic youth organization to, quote, counter the ominous and omnipresent power of the secret Jewish Masonic organization, unquote. Cuesta Gallardo's secret group was called the Tecos, Vega continued. The school was founded in 1935, according to the version cited in university publications, when students headed by Cuesta along with sympathetic faculty broke from the state university and started UAG to counteract what they saw as Mexico's socialist educational system. The stated goal was to uphold academic freedom and to oppose dogmatic and totalitarian government interference by creating a university free from political or religious partisanship. Take that with a generous grain of salt, as we're going to see here in a second. According to accounts by some former students, the Tecos infiltrated key administrative and student posts and gained control of the Autonomous, suppressing all political and ideological opposition. Mexican politician Ignacio González Golaz, G-O-L-L-A-Z, who said he was one of the students forced out of the UAG's secondary school in 1940, wrote that the secret groups were controlled by a Supreme Council headed by Cuesta. According to González, one of the requirements for membership on the Supreme Council was to pass a doctrinal examination based on anti-Jewish writings. Below the Supreme Council were groups and subgroups that spied on other students and one another to ensure maximum loyalty, he wrote in 1940. Inductees had to swear by God and by my honor, unquote, not to reveal the name of the organization, its members, or its activities during an initiation ritual conducted before a crucifix, a skull, and a dagger. Members of the Supreme Council, as identified by González Golaz, include the current UAG rector, Luis Garibay, we spoke about him before, the current vice-rector, Antonio Leano, and law professor Raimundo Guerrero. One knowledgeable foreign observer described Leano as the most important person in the school today. He has contributed significant amounts of money, and members of his family hold several key positions. Pointer being that the Los Tecos has taken over and has been running the Autonomous University of Guadalajara since about 1935, and from the description given by many of the people involved with it, or who have experienced its wrath and survived, it appears to be almost like the SS Ordensburgen, the schools that were set up especially by Himmler to raise his SS cadets. Certainly, it is a totalitarian and a fascist institution tout ensemble, as we're going to see here. But again, keep in mind that this organization not only
was pumped up with this, with Mr. Wiegand's money coming from the State Department and AID, but also basically this whole group was founded, the CAL, that is, was founded by U.S. intelligence going back to the Arbenz overthrow.
That's right. And bear in mind, again, Dave's comparison to the Ordensburg and the SS training centers as we look at this next section of the article. You're reading a little further on in the article that we had started earlier by Craig Pies. Two names here. One of them you've already heard, CAL, and of course the other one that gets mentioned is FEMACO, or FEMACO, F-E-M-A-C-O. That stands for Federación Mexicano Anticomunista, the Mexican Anti-Communist Federation. This is a group that actually started before CAL was officially named that, and later on joined CAL once CAL had come into existence. So FEMACO is the group that nominally puts out the magazine Replica that we were talking about, that equates Judaism with witchery and communism, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Other League officials interviewed, this is World Anti-Communist League officials, said CAL and FEMACO were expelled. The man identified by the Pasonis are the Stefan Pasoni and his wife, who are actually conservatives, members themselves affiliated with the World Anti-Communist League. Pasoni is affiliated with the Hoover Institute right here in the area and the Reagan administration. The man identified by the Pasonis as second in command of the Tecos was Rafael Rodriguez. He's also a professor, by the way, at the UAG. Who has worked closely with Raimundo Guerrero on the international scene. Rodriguez, who declined to be interviewed by telephone, founded and ran CAL, which worked directly with South American military dictatorships frequently praised by Rodriguez in his speeches. In September 1980, Rodriguez and Argentine and intelligence operatives who made up CAL's organizing committee held a conference in Buenos Aires with the aim of exporting South America's methods of dealing with communism to Central America. Quote, our fundamental objective, Rodriguez told the conferees in a speech reprinted in the October 1980 edition of Replica, is to return home with harsh, concrete plans derived from the interchange of experiences between those in the Southern Cone, who now should know how to solve the problems of communist subversion, and those in Central America just starting to face them. Unquote. The conference itself had the blessing of Argentine President Jorge Videla, and other military officials who have been on trial, and I should mention subsequently convicted, for their part in directing the kidnapped murders of 9,000 civilians as part of their internal security efforts. Videla was convicted for his part in the dirty war last week, okay, and sentenced to life imprisonment. During the conference, Salvadoran rightist Roberto Dabuisson arranged for Argentine advisors to be sent to El Salvador, where they worked with rightist death squads. The leaders of the Argentine advisors was identified as Alfredo Freddy Zaratini, head of Argentina's National Socialist, or Nazi, Party, and co-organizer of the conference with Rodriguez. The Argentines, who went to Central America after the 1980 Buenos Aires conference, preached a combination of violent hatred of the Jews and counterinsurgency techniques based on mass murder. Quote, the Argentines worked closely with CAL. Francisco Chico Girola said during a 1982 interview. Girola, a close Dabuisson aide who was convicted earlier this year of attempting to smuggle $6 million in suspected drug money out of the United States, knew the Argentines well. Quote, they, CAL, have their own training camps, he said. They have their own brotherhoods. They're well organized all over the world. Their center is the Autónoma de Guadalajara. On the surface, the Autónoma is calm and placid. Its 20,000 students talk casually on manicured lawns in front of modern buildings and appear serious, proper, and upscale. There have been no reports of hostility toward the many Jewish students enrolled in the medical school and the exchange programs.
We're going to be talking about the medical school in a little bit.
Indeed. Although offices are adorned with owls in every medium and every form, and by the way, Tecos is short for Tecolote, which means owl.
By the way, interrupting also, the owl is an ancient occult symbol, and a lot of there's a strong intersection between fascism and the occult, and a lot of the groups that sort of tread that boundary use the owl as a symbol. It's also, interestingly enough, the symbol for the Bohemian Grove, a tremendous power center which convenes north of here every year, involving people like Henry Kissinger, the Buckleys, Al Haig, and a lot of other luminaries of the so-called respectable right.
Maybe we can call it the Autónoma Grove from now on. From photographs to flower pots to candle holders, the owls adorn every medium and every form. there is little to indicate the presence of another kind of Teiko. However, some American students have seen or felt enough to be concerned. Quote, "Stuff goes on underneath here that I know I'll never know about," said a student from New Mexico who asked not to be identified. "If you ask anybody at the university what the Teikos do, they say it's a good organization that promotes school involvement. But people outside say it's a spy organization." James Lessinger, who was a medical student at UAG in the mid-1970s and who now is a doctor in California, described the school's dual nature. Quote, "On the surface, it," meaning the Teikos, "was a student body organization like the UCLA Bruins. But when you started getting deeper and deeper, it was like Hitler Youth," he said. "Then they had this kind of secret society that would do paramilitary and military training, that would have spies in various student organizations, that would have sessions and training about capitalism versus communism, and political and military indoctrination." Again, very much, as Dave mentioned, like the Ordensburg. American students said the indoctrination classes, called encuentros, or encounters, were taught by professors and instructors at the school and were aimed entirely at the Latin student body. North American students were deliberately kept out. Okay, so again, we see an organization that is running on several different levels, and one of those levels being it is actually serving much the function of the Hitler Youth training facilities. Also at the same time, we know that there are American students, some of whom obviously have not gotten involved with these kinds of things and have stayed away, and maybe in fact we're not even aware that these things are going on, although these two who were quoted in the article seemed to realize something was going on. But also American students and presumably other international students are also coming in to the Autonomous University in Guadalajara.
Okay, now remember, too, that the connections between the American universities and the UAG, because as we're going to see in another Anderson column here, American professors there are required to join Los Teikos for all intents and purposes. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, November 26, 1984, they ran Anderson's column under the title Lunatic Fringe in Mexico. "I stirred up a hornet's nest in September when I reported that the heart of Latin American death squad activity beats most strongly in Guadalajara, Mexico, where the Autonomous University appears to be influenced by an ultra-rightist, anti-Semitic secret society called Los Teikos. The university, founded as a counterweight to the left-leaning government universities, was quick to respond. University authorities authored a paid rebuttal in the Washington Post that claimed, among other things, that the university is non-political." "This is a joke," says Anderson. "My concern lay with the information obtained by my associates John Lee Anderson and Dale Van Atta that the clandestine Los Teikos Society exercised a malign influence on the university. The point I was trying to make was confirmed by one indignant caller who telephoned in defense of the university." Okay, remember now this next argument is in defense of Los Teikos. "He said he was an American professor there and insisted on anonymity, but his remarks were revealing. After he praised the university lavishly, my associates asked if he was a member of Los Teikos. After a long pause, he said he was. Is it a right-wing society? Yes, he said. Why had he joined? It was expected of both American and Mexican professors who taught there, he replied. Did he know of any other American professors who had joined Los Teikos? Well, he said, he knew of one who had refused to join and, quote, was always in trouble for this, unquote. Had he ever witnessed any violence by Los Teikos? No, said the professor. That was another part of the group, not the one to which he belonged. He explained that Los Teikos consisted of three divisions, the administrators, professors, and school officials who were members, the student spies who kept their eyes on suspected left-leaning professors and students, and the Teikos de Choque, or shock troops. The professor said he had no idea what the strong-arm division did." Well, strong-arm divisions usually do one thing, and that is impose violence on other people, okay? That's generally what it means. "Could the shock troops be involved directly or indirectly in death squad activities? It wouldn't surprise him," the professor replied. Well, obviously, dealing with the information about the Rodriguez, the CAL and the Los Teikos, the Autonoma de Guadalajara, are obviously heavily, heavily involved with death squads. As I said, they could be thought of as the wrist of La Mano Blanco, the White Hand. And remember, The CAL, founded out of U.S. intelligence after the Arbenz overthrow. This Society Los Tecos is an explicitly fascist society which has been running this university as basically a fascist finishing school since 1935. In the late 60s, it gets pumped up courtesy of the U.S. government and adds fuel to the death squad fire in Latin America, again with U.S. intelligence at its core. And again, considering the World Anti-Communist League as the reconvening of the Comintern, as a second anti-Comintern, and obviously a primary proponent of the Freikorps methodology.
Okay, and one last thing to think about before we take a break. Those of you who have been longtime listeners to Dave and myself here on KFJC will remember us talking about Jonestown, about the numerous strange and bizarre events surrounding Jonestown and the death there of some 900 to 1,000 people. And the allegations by, among other people, Joe Holtzinger, Leo Ryan's press secretary, that Jonestown was in fact some kind of a CIA operation, perhaps a mind control operation. And we talked about this at some length. We certainly have talked about all the suspicious things about Jonestown that we will not go into now, but it's definite and almost undeniable ties to American intelligence. I'm just going to read a short thing, bearing in mind Los Tecos and the stuff that we've just read about, their organization and their founding by Americans and with American government money. The fact that the CIA or the people who initiated the death squads in the first place in Latin America, and apparently as Dave just read in the last article, the continuing indoctrination of people, faculty members and others, Americans and others, at the Autonomous University in Guadalajara. We're going to consider this very short segment here from a book called 6 Years with God, Life Inside Reverend Jim Jones' People's Temple by Jeannie Mills, copyright 1979, A&W Publishers in New York.
By the way, the Mills, shortly after this book came out, were assassinated in the middle of downtown Berkeley. Well, that's where they lived. That both the Mills, Jeannie and Al Mills, and their youngest daughter were machine-gunned in their own home in an as-yet unsolved killing shortly after this book came out.
Okay, now in this book, in the Mills' book, there's a page here that we have reproduced. On this page is shown reproduced a copy of one page of a People's Temple pamphlet called Apostolic Living Today. In this case, it's a little biography of a People's Temple member named Larry Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T. And reading from the People's Temple pamphlet that is reproduced in the book by the Mills, it says, "Now Larry, along with another young man, Steve Buckmaster, who also had a background of drugs, is attending medical college in Mexico, sponsored by People's Temple. He and Steve have dedicated their lives to helping others. They plan to be doctors in a People's Temple free clinic as soon as they graduate." We don't know offhand if this is the Autonomous University of Guadalajara, but it's quite possible. Right next to it, the Millses have printed, "This article was printed in one of the temple pamphlets. It is testimony about Larry Schacht. Larry was a doctor and was the person who mixed and administered the poison that killed 912 people."
Okay, so perhaps he was a student at the Autonomous University. Certainly that seems a very reasonable possibility. That is, at this point, though, as we like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. Another little bit of perhaps disgusting, another nauseating hors d'oeuvre here from the fascist Lazy Susan, I guess you could say, is the fact that, again, there's an active program of cooperation between the Autonoma and 13 U.S. universities, and American professors are required to join Los Tecos. So as you observe the Mexican Ordensburgen and consider its contacts with U.S. intelligence, just remember the old saying from the street that what goes around comes around.
Okay, and speaking of going around, I'm going to put a couple of songs on the turntable, let them go around Communist League again, and we have started out the first part of the broadcast tonight. For those of you who just tuned in, we talked about its involvement in Latin America starting in 1954 when the CIA put together an army of mercenaries to overthrow the democratically elected government of Guatemala, which we objected to and which United Fruit objected to, and at that point plunged Guatemala into 30 years of probably among the most repressive government in the world, and highlighted, of course, by death squad activity in extremis. And we talked about the origins of the death squads, how they came out of, largely came out of that 1954 coup sponsored by the CIA, and how they are affiliated through various Latin American groups, most notably CAL, which we talked about at some length. And we trace CAL to a university that was founded in Mexico with the help of United States government funds in the early 1960s and is now operating independently almost by itself as the center of Latin American death squad activities, according to many sources, and is possessed of a sub-government or a shadow government of this university based on anti-Semitism, Nazism, and the training of students and faculty members, including apparently American faculty members, according to one of the last Jack Anderson columns we read, in these various principles of fascism and anti-Semitism, and apparently also graduating many American students, at least 10,000 of them, with doctoral degrees. Now, whether all of them received training, I doubt, but certainly some of them were exposed to it, and as we mentioned, one of the ones exposed to it was the man who prepared the poison to kill the people at Jonestown, Larry Schacht, that he was, as far as we can tell, it sounded as though that was the university that he attended, was the Autonomous University of Guadalajara. So we have traced the activities of the World Anti-Communist League up to this point in this particular narrow field, the Latin American branch, and also specifically, as we mentioned, this Guadalajara University.
Okay, now, again, hang on. We're having some problems with the mics.
I have no idea why that microphone is not functioning properly.
Let's see.
Everything else seems to be on.
Let's just try one thing here.
Just pop them up and pop them down again, and we'll see.
Okay, now, let's see. And now, are we coming through?
No, not really. Well,
let's put the tape. More over-the-counter radio, as we like to put it. Anyway, considering now the Wackel as, again, the second anti-Comintern, we're going to take up now a group called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. We're going to begin reading from a section of an essay called The Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. It's an unpublished essay. Again, Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and one of the top political researchers in this country. In 1971, he published a it's unpublished, but he copyrighted a massive essay called The Dallas Conspiracy about the assassination of President Kennedy. It's a relatively early work, but it's got a lot of important information. Reviewing briefly a section of The Dallas Conspiracy about the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, which we talked about before. Again, the next few pages I'm going to be reading a review from Radio Free America number 14, our first program about the World Anti-Communist League. We're going to be taking up the ABN and Wackel's role in the assassination of Kennedy, recalling that Mr. Valladares, head of the CAL, and one of the people who's helped steer the conferences resulting in Wackel, the lawyer for Carlos Marcello, involved in the Kennedy assassination, as we saw in Guns of November number 1. Also, remember that Maurice Brooks Gatlin of 544 Camp Street, as we also looked at in Radio Free America number 1, also in Guns of November number 1, also Radio Free America number 12, was very much involved with the 544 Camp Street address used by Oswald. Keep those connections in mind here. Reading now from The Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. The Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN, with its American lobby, the AF-ABN, the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Nations, was similar to, but slightly to the right of, the CIA-supported Assembly of Captive European Nations, or ACEN, with its U.S. CIA front, the American Friends of the Captive Nations, headed by Christopher Emmett. Whereas the ACEN lobbied for the liberation, unquote, of Poland, Czechoslovakia, and the rest of the area between the Iron Curtain and the USSR, the ABN also looked for the liberation of the Ukraine, Armenia, Georgia, Kosakia, Azerbaijan, Idel-Ural, Turkestan, and of other ethnic nationalities inside the 1939 borders of the Soviet Union. Recall that in our last program, we took a look at Dr. Theodor Oberlander, a key Galen aide, a key SS man who had been very active with the Nazi Ostpolitik and involved with many of these groups which the ABN sought to have liberated from the Soviet Union, actually parts of the Soviet Union which they sought to have broken off from that nation. Oberlander, of course, a key member of Wackel, also a member of a group called the Committee for the Preservation of Christian Culture. And that, of course, is an organization that was heavily involved with the Galen organization. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 14. We also looked at it in number 13 briefly. But Bunker Hunt of the John Birch Society and of the Aryan Nations, as we looked at, was a key member of that organization with Theodor Oberlander. Again, we looked at that
In Radio Free America number 14, also in number 13, both at the end. At the heart of the ABN Alliance, continuing now with the Dallas conspiracy, at the heart of the ABN Alliance were the resources of two actual post-war underground movements, the Hungarian Freedom Fighters and the Ukrainian OUN, or Underground Army. Interrupting, the Ukrainian OUN are the Bandaruski we looked at as carrying on guerrilla warfare on behalf of first the Galen Organization and then the CIA-sponsored Galen Organization. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 1 right at the end. Key name, a fellow named Frank Wisner, deputy director of the CIA, head of the Office of Policy Coordination, who brought the OUN Bandera in. Bandera is going to figure very, very prominently in this broadcast, continuing with the Dallas conspiracy. By 1960, however, the ABN had come to concentrate on psychological and political warfare. Thus, it competed with Russian emigre organizations such as the NTS, to be discussed shortly, for places in U.S.-supported Psy-War activities like Radio Liberation, later renamed Radio Liberty in Munich. It also participated in planning for a grand world alliance of world anti-communist forces to be called the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, or WACCFL, whose composition is indicated by the 15-man steering committee elected at a preparatory conference in Mexico City in March of 1958. We read some of those names to you last time. The Mexico City Conference was itself called in response to the Taipei Statement of an international group meeting in October of 1957 in Taiwan. Chiang Kai-shek of Taiwan, Syngman Rhee of South Korea, and Diem of South Vietnam were each represented in this steering committee by a top figure in their respective party apparatus. German veterans of Hitler's frustrated anti-Comintern and Ostpolitik programs were included, notably Fritz Kramer of the CIAS, Committee for Information and Social Activity, a former officer of the Abwehr in Riga and Lisbon from 1939 to 1945. Alfred Gehlen, CIAS Secretary General and a former Nazi publicist for Goebbels' anti-Comintern, became the WACCFL Steering Committee's Regional Secretary for Europe. Now, this Mr. Gehlen, who worked in turn with Fritz Kramer and who also worked for a fellow named Taubert, Eberhard Taubert, under the Goebbels ministry, and recall that one of the key American links with WACCO is the American Security Council, which relies in part on the anti-Semitic files of a man named Harry Jung, who was also part of the anti-Comintern Pact and worked with the Goebbels apparatus in the United States. So we have, at least in the persons of Gehlen and Taubert, and their relationship with Fritz Kramer, and in turn, their connection to the American Security Council using the files of Harry Jung, what Niptuck referred to as recombinant ASC, in other words, a reconvening of the anti-Comintern nations. Continuing. The American representatives were veteran China lobbyist Charles Edison of the John Birch Society, John Birch Society and American Security Council, and Lev Dobryansky, a Ukrainian-American Army Reserve officer and professor at Georgetown University with close links to Army intelligence circles. I would also add that he, under the Reagan administration, became Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. I think he has since been removed. The ABN had two of the 15 seats on the World Committee, one less than Latin America. Its representatives were Yaroslav Stetsko, S-T-E-T-Z-K-O, briefly a premier of the short-lived Ukrainian Republic at the time of the 1941 German invasion, and Ferenc Farkas, F-A-R-K-A-S, the ABN military chief who commanded the Army of Arrow Cross Chief Ferenc Szalasi, executed as a war criminal against the Russians in World War II. By 1962, both the new anti-Comintern movement and the American Friends of the ABN in particular were profoundly dissatisfied with the Kennedy State Department. Rusk, in opposing the demands of the AF-ABN and allied groups for a permanent Congressional Captive Nations Committee, and I seem to have lost my sheet here. Oh, never mind, here we go, got it. Okay, excuse me. Picking this up again. Rusk, in opposing the demands of the AF-ABN and allied groups for a permanent Congressional Captive Nations Committee, went out of his way to refer to Ukraine, Armenia, and Georgia not as nations, but as traditional parts of the Soviet Union, unquote. Rusk did not want the U.S. in the undesirable position of seeming to advocate the dismemberment of an historical state, unquote. This Rusk letter, like other features of the Kennedy administration's Russian policy, was repeatedly polemicized against by ABN and other emigre elements, including a sympathetic veteran of Army intelligence, Charles Willoughby of the American Security Council. Now, of course, Charles Willoughby, MacArthur's G2, key member of not only the American Security Council, but also the Birch Society, Young Americans for Freedom, and the Aryan Nations. And, of course, he's directly involved with the whole MacArthur group that we developed in our Aryan Nations thesis.
Okay, now, as mentioned here, several members of this these Eastern European revanchist groups, of course, the Rusk statements were among the things that they had against the Kennedy administration. They had other things against the Kennedy administration, too, and they had one very large fear, and that was, of course, that John F. Kennedy would make peace of some sort with Nikita Khrushchev, because both Kennedy and Khrushchev had a rapport that had been heretofore unknown between American and Russian leaders. Khrushchev had a great deal of respect for Kennedy, and Kennedy also, in turn, for Khrushchev. And it was probably the respect that these two men had for each other that averted a real catastrophe at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway, so these two men did feel that they had a rapport that was special between the two nations and was unprecedented to that point so far. We're going to read about the results of this, and we're going to begin to speculate on the possible results of this that have not yet been accepted as the part of history that perhaps they should have been. We're going to start by reading from a section from a book, KAL Flight 007, The Hidden Story. The book is by Oliver Klubb, C-L-U-B-B. It's copyright 1985 by the Permanent Press. It says, during the final year of his presidency, John F. Kennedy would also make a break. In his famous American University speech of June 10, 1963, with America's past policies toward the Soviet Union. Quote, the president was determined, wrote Theodore Sorensen, to put a fundamentally new emphasis on the peaceful and the positive in our relations with the Soviets. He did not want that new policy diluted by the usual threats of destruction, boasts of nuclear stockpiles, and lectures on Soviet treachery, unquote. By the way, those of you, again, to refer to the present day, you might compare that to Ronald Reagan's references to the Soviet Union as the evil empire and the focus of evil on Earth today. In his speech, Kennedy therefore called upon the American people to, quote, re-examine our attitude toward the Soviet Union, unquote. Both the United States and the Soviet Union, quote, have a mutually deep interest, he affirmed, in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. So, let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. Having said these things, Kennedy announced that negotiations would soon take place in Moscow to seek agreement on a comprehensive nuclear test ban. And he took the further step to, quote, make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on the matter of declaring that the United States would not conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere, so long as other countries also refrain from doing so. Richard J. Barnett has very well summarized the Russian reaction to Kennedy's speech. Soviet citizens found it electrifying. For months, some carried clippings of it in their wallets. It was an appeal for an end to the Cold War, the first speech by an American president in more than a decade and a half to mention that the people of the Soviet Union were human beings and to pay tribute to their bravery and suffering in the war. It marked the first official attempt to exorcise the devil theory that determined official attitudes and public opinion towards the Soviet Union. Khrushchev himself told Averill Harriman, the chief American negotiator at the nuclear test ban talks in Moscow, that Kennedy's address had been, quote, the greatest speech by an American president since Roosevelt. The Soviets suspended their own atmospheric nuclear tests in response to Kennedy's unilateral initiative. And on July 25th, a mere 6 weeks after Kennedy's American University speech, a treaty banning atmospheric tests was signed in Moscow.
And I would add that that is virtually the only substantive arms limitation agreement ever worked out between the U.S. and the USSR.
You might also bear in mind that at this point that Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has recently said that he has temporarily, unilaterally banned nuclear testing himself, and the Reagan administration has said that there's no way that they're going to follow up on something like that, that it's a gross Soviet trick, et cetera, and that we have to keep testing our nuclear arsenals. So these things are still going on, folks. This is very current and very valid. As we know, continued underground testing was permitted by the treaty. Kennedy, confronted by Pentagon demands for, quote, the conduct of comprehensive, aggressive, and continuous underground test programs, had been reluctant to press for a total test ban. So the arms race continued, and the momentum towards peace, which had been set in motion by Kennedy's speech, was arrested when, on November 22nd, President Kennedy was assassinated.
Okay, now, again, President Kennedy had angered the revanchist East Europeans, the ABN, and also people called the Solidarists, who we're going to be talking about, the NTS, in a number of ways. He, through Dean Rusk, his Secretary of State, had refused to endorse the partition program for the southern nationalities of the Soviet Union and the Ukraine. Beyond that, he had worked out the first and, to date, the most substantive arms limitation agreement ever worked out between the two countries, and was moving to bring relations to the two, basically end the Cold War and bring about a relatively, at least courteous and decent, peaceful, if not affectionate relationship between the United States and Soviet Union. Of course, obviously, that stands very, very much against the ABN and the whole CIA Galen apparatus that we've been discussing for these many years here. Now, one of the details that we talked about in Guns of November number 4, we also brought it up in our first Wackel show, concerns the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, when he returned to the United States, was met by Spaz T. Rakin, who was the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Nations. Okay, and we're going to continue now with The Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott from 1971, and we're going to deal with Oswald and the implications of his connections to the AFABN through Spaz Rakin, and of course, keep in mind the Galen and CIA connections to this group as well. Reading now from the Dallas Conspiracy. Was Oswald ignored by the FBI in New York City and instead met for and cared for by Spaz T. Rakin, the Secretary General of the AFABN? So the report would have us believe, the report being the Warren Report here. But a simpler and less conspiratorial explanation, albeit unprovable, is that Rakin was himself some kind of agent either for the FBI or some analogous agency such as the CIA or Army Intelligence. If he was not, then the contact and or surveillance which one would expect from the FBI had somehow been delegated to a member of a right-wing political organization which, despite its intelligence connections, was directly engaged in a bitter polemic with the Kennedy administration. And of course, right-wing organizations have frequently, as we've looked at, functioned as extensions of the intelligence community. Just witness the Autonomy in Guadalajara and Los Tecos. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy. This polemic, that is the ABN people against Kennedy, this polemic dealt not only with the issue of rolling back communism in Eastern Europe, but also with the politically related issues of a permanent Volunteer Freedom Corps, or U.S.-supported Foreign Legion, a permanent Freedom Academy for training in psychological warfare, and a permanent Captive Nations Committee of the U.S. Congress. Now, of course, keep in mind that the Autonomous University could be looked upon as a Freedom Academy for training in psychological warfare. Also, of course, with the Contras, with the La Mano Blanco death squads, with the people that we're going to be looking at in connection with the assassination of Kennedy and also the shooting, possibly, of Swedish Premier Olof Palme. And again, hearkening back to our Aryan Nations program, this Volunteer Freedom Corps would appear to be very, very much with us today. And again, the Freikorps methodology being front and center here, the Wackel being the international version of it, the Aryan Nations being the American national version of it. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy. On the first two issues, the AF-ABN position was also lobbied for vigorously by the APACL, that's the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, the Asian branch of WACL, and also in America by the American Security Council, a private coalition of industrial, of course, as we looked at the American Security Council, the main American link to WACL. About the American Security Council, Scott writes, a private coalition of industrialists and intelligence veterans which had been set up in 1955 by ex-agents of the FBI. The American Security Council, like Fritz Kramer's sister outfit in West Germany, the VFF, ran security checks on individuals seeking employment in private industry. Its index of over 1 million alleged subversives was based on the anti-Semitic files of Harry A. Jung's American Vigilant Intelligence Federation, which had collaborated with the Goebbels-Taubert anti-Comintern in the 30s. We discussed that before. Remember key names with regard to American Security Council, not only Charles Willoughby, but also Albert Wiedemeyer of the China Lobby and the MacArthur Group and the Kriegswehr Academy, who we looked at, also of the Reagan administration, and also Patrick Frawley, who is a key Reagan supporter and early financer, also connected with Ed Butler from the WDSU Oswald interview from Guns of November number 1. Continuing with the Dallas Conspiracy. Lev Dobryansky, described in Who's Who as the author of the Congressional Captive Nations Week resolution, and former Army General Charles Willoughby, MacArthur's top intelligence officer, were perhaps the two leading supporters of the ABN and Ukrainian cause. Both men were Republicans associated with Robert Morris and the American Security Council and in interlocking right-wing organizations such as the Young Americans for Freedom Advisory Board. Both men opposed the pro-Russian sympathies of the CIA, that should be taken in quotes, and had connections with the FBI, the Army, and the Army Reserve, which will figure permanently in the Oswald narrative. Dobryansky, who taught regularly at Georgetown University, also taught at the Army's National War College. In 1958, he was appointed lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve's 352nd Division for Military Government Civil Affairs, with responsibility vaguely reminiscent of the movie 7 Days in May. I'm going to read that last sentence again. Again, Dobryansky, Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas, key figure in WACL and the ABN. In 1958, he was appointed lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve's 352nd Division for Military Government Civil Affairs, with responsibilities vaguely reminiscent of the movie 7 Days in May. Of course, with our Aryan Nation series, we looked at the Kennedy assassination as the culmination of a series of coups based around the Morgan and MacArthur groups and the China lobby, in which they had attempted to overthrow the government. Obviously, with the Kennedy assassination, they did.
And part of the reference here is that, of course, the movie 7 Days in May was about an attempted takeover of the United States by an extreme right-wing clique of generals to be headed up by the assassination of the President of the United States. In the movie, it was foiled. Art does not always imitate life.
Continuing now with the Dallas conspiracy. Anthony Buscari, a third pro-ABN spokesman associated with Dobryansky and Willoughby in the American Security Council and the Young Americans for Freedom, attracts our attention because, like Oswald, he served in the Marines. Okay, so again, the WACL group, and with Dobryansky being in a military group with responsibilities for instituting, for all intents and purposes, a military government, consider the whole thesis that we've been developing of the Kennedy assassination as the culmination of a constitutional struggle and the overthrow of the government. Nip Talk's about to read you now from a book called Galen, Spy of the Century, and reviewing briefly who Galen is. Reinhard Galen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front. At the end of World War II, he jumped to the CIA with his entire organization still intact. Then the Galen organization became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, was responsible for all the intelligence which we got on that part of the world for a long time, then became, for all intents and purposes, the NATO intelligence organization, and eventually the BND, the West German Intelligence Service, which it is to this day. Now, Nip's going to read you about a series of assassinations which took place in conjunction with the Galen organization, or sort of within that milieu. And one of the key names to remember here is the death of Stefan Bandera. He's the fellow brought into the country along with his guerrilla groups, which waged fierce guerrilla warfare, first for the Nazis, then for the CIA against the USSR. And Frank Wisner of the Office of Policy Coordination and CIA was the key figure involved in bringing Bandera into the country. Now we're going to read about his death and how it keys in with the Kennedy assassination.
Now again, bear in mind that one of the reasons, now this is, as Dave was mentioning before we began the broadcast tonight, this is the kind of intelligence, counterintelligence, espionage, counter-espionage stuff that we generally tend to stay away from because it gets exceedingly confusing, and there's very seldom, if ever, a concrete resolution to what actually was done.
Plus, most of the information generally generated by both sides is intended to a large extent to confuse the other, and woe unto the independent researcher.
Exactly, and it usually succeeds in doing just that. However, just to give an idea, if nothing else, of how these organizations were set up and the kinds of fierce rivalries within the organizations and the willingness, again, because we're talking about people who we feel were, among other things, were, although on one hand working for American intelligence, were also willing to kill an American president. And it's important to realize what kinds of fanatical and bizarre loyalties were put together in these groups.
Beyond that, the Bandera assassination may have been, we don't know for sure because obviously we haven't got the final goods, but it may have been a provocation. And it's figuring in the background of the Kennedy assassination is the reason here why we're taking up the field of hard counterintelligence. I guess you could call it spy versus spy, which we normally stay away from because, as we've indicated, it tends to be an impenetrable maze. But here, not only are there some clues as to what was happening, but obviously it's directly connected to the overthrow of the U.S. government, so we're going to take it up.
Okay. Again, reading from the book Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, copyright 1971, Random House, New York. The author Cookridge writes under the heading of The Cyanic Acid Murders.